spent an inordinate amount of time last night playing around with Drupal as a consequence of your request for a week.
So I really do think you should have Ashish the undergrad.
To
who? Ashish the undergrad. You know, he's inside it.
Okay, I would. Can you introduce us?
Yeah.
Could it be helpful? Okay, so in this trivia, with apologies, because this was not the plan, I'm going to do a midterm. Midterm will cover readings, and let me explain why I'm doing this, because I don't want to do this. I'm doing this because come the end of the semester, I will need to issue a grade. And the truth of the matter is that in the upper level courses, I proceed on the assumption that A, you're smart enough to actually read the papers without being kicked around, and B, if you're not, you deserve to fail. On the other hand, I do assume, and usually it seems to be ratified, that students who take upper level courses are interested in the topic, and they'll engage, and as long as they engage, they do fine. So my expectation, frankly, is that the midterm will be pretty pro forma, and that everybody will do fine. And at this level, I'm not interested in building a grading curve. My model for grading roughly in an upper level course is, there are people who really, really manage to earn an F. You have to work at it, but you can do it if you try. There are people who sort of sit back and relax. And, at this level, frankly, if you're paying attention, you're still getting a lot of material, and that's not something we should penalize. And there are people who put in extraordinary effort, and that really ought to get recognized. But I'm not, come on, we've got 10 people in the room, right? Trying to talk about building a grading curve at this level is really stupid. The dean doesn't like it? Tough. Dean really wants to see grading curves. Too bad. What I want is for you guys to read the papers. Okay, so I'm going to do that. I will get a timeout. Also, you can ignore the reading assignment for this week. The code assignment, if you've already read it. That comment really actually is worth reading, if only for a good chuckle. But, this comment has been slashed on it. It's actually pretty funny. What I want to talk today about is napping. But I want to... I want to start by trying to lay out a problem. We're trying to lay out the dimensions of what we'd like in this solution. And I've been engaged in a kind of an interesting dialogue with the herd people over the last 48 hours. In fact, more or less continuously over the last 48 hours. This is what happens when you have a small child who don't sleep very well to begin with. And some interesting things have come out of that conversation that have framed the discussion in a way that I hadn't seen before. It's amazing what you can do to clarify a discussion when you're in the awkward position of competing with somebody else who has this competing design, and you really actually like the other guy, so you don't want to say that they're assholes, but there is a problem and you want to be straightforward about it, and you find all sorts of nice ways to sort of neutralize the discussion about the design and talk about facts and not talk about value judgment. So I think I've got an answer when we talk about that I've had before. Let me propose some desirable properties, both for systems in general and for a mapping system. So the first one, and this is a systems in general property, is we really want storage accountability. Okay. Here's the way to think about this. If you have a sort of a contract for performing something in a system, and it relies on the wrong party paying for the storage. In particular, if the party who can delete the storage or destroy the storage or reclaim the storage is not the party who's on the hook, who's getting accounted for having allocated the storage. And not that they're paying money, but it's coming out of their pool of resource. Right? If you're the party supplying the pool of resource and you're not the party who can sensibly revoke the access to that resource, okay, then either your contract's broken or the wrong guy's paying and you need to figure out how to fix that. And the context in which this came up over the weekend was we were talking about designs that rely on reference counting. Now, reference counting sounds like a good idea, and it's a very attractive idea, right? It says, hey, I'd like to know when the last party's done, because then I can reclaim the resource. In fact, the resource will automatically get reclaimed. The problem with this is when you look at the interaction between reference counting and quotas. Okay. So always, in a reference counting system, you have somebody who allocates, and I'm going to call that the instantiator, because I don't really want to restrict my attention here to allocations. There's a broader issue with instantiating things in general. Okay. And you have some receiver, okay? And what I want to say here is a little awkward, because the word I'd like to use is user, but I don't mean a human. I mean a program that's using this thing that got instantiated. Let me call it a receiver of the thing. Okay. These two things are processes. Okay. And somewhere, you have some resource that's the one that got instantiated. Or really from the system's point of view, the resource already existed, it's just that now we've sort of allocated it to somebody and later we're going to reclaim it. Okay. Now, so the instantiator somehow requests this resource, gets it allocated, gets a capability to it, and we've now got a quota. Okay? And if I could spell, we would have a quota. And the quota says, okay, this party has now allocated one resource, and he's got two left before he runs out of quota. And now the instantiator says, okay, I've allocated this resource. I would like to use it in collaboration with the receiver. So I'm going to pass the receiver a capability to this object. How am I going to do that? I'm going to send a message via our handy-dandy IPC system, okay? And this message is going to contain the capability of the object, and after the message is received, the receiver is going to have the capability. So far, there's nothing terribly unusual here. But it might turn out that at some point, I'm kind of done with this thing, okay? So after this transfer, the reference count on this thing is 2, right? Because I've got it and the receiver's got it. Now I drop my capability. Good. So this guy's gone, okay? And the reference count goes to 1. But you notice the object is still hanging around. The reason the object is still hanging around is the receiver has still got a capability, and sometimes that's what I want. And sometimes I intend that the receiver's use of this object should survive my giving it up. In fact, maybe even should survive my exit. But sometimes it's not what I intend. Now the problem here is if the receiver is hostile, or if the receiver is simply in error and misbehaves, the receiver may never give up this capability. Suppose it just it falls, right? It stops executing instructions. It enters an infinite loop. It decides that it's really important to find out what time it is on Pluto. It's waiting for the response. You know, some operation like this that's sort of really inconveniently long from the perspective of the poor guy who's paying for this resource. And that resource is not going to get free until that reference count goes. Now, here is a truth in the design of robust systems. Even if it's through blind, blazing stupidity, it's always a safe assumption that the client program is out to get you. Doesn't mean the author is hostile, right? It means they're just an ordinary quality program. That is a regrettably necessary and definitely sufficient condition for operational hostility in the system. Okay? And the rule, there's a law of nature that if you're the defender, the other guy has always got more resource than you do. And if they don't, my grandmother will put windows on the net and will help them acquire more, so you can count on it. ActiveX is the best Linux installer one could possibly imagine. Think about it. I'm waiting for the demo. Click here to install Linux. Do you really mean it? Because we really do. No, we're not kidding. Okay. There was a website for a while that if you went to the website, it would maximize your web screen, and it would do a credible job of looking like it was tearing down your Windows desktop and deinstalling Windows and installing Mac OS. God, it scared the hell out of my mother. I just want to do it for real. Okay, so the problem with these ref counts is you notice now the wrong party is paying, assuming we want the resource back. I mean, if what we want is for this resource and this client of the resource to remain alive, we're still good, okay? But if what we want is for the resource to come back, we've got a problem, because in a reference count-based system, it's not just that we do use reference counts, it's that we generally don't have any other mechanism for reclamation. In particular, most systems that use reference counts use only reference counts, and they provide no mechanism to explicitly destroy the object. When you delete a file in Unix, it doesn't go away until the last holder of a file descriptor lets go. And the reason that's okay, or at least the reason it used to be okay, was that the uptime of Unix wasn't very long, so that wasn't going to take very long. But when the uptime of Unix is measured in years, that's no longer an acceptable design. I mean, look, if the window of vulnerability on your quota is only 8 hours until the next crash, this is not an earth-shattering problem. The crash may be a problem, but the quota issue is not a problem. Right? This is called masking one hazard with another. Okay, so there's a second issue, which is there exist systems, and we don't tend to use them very often day to day, but there exist environments where they are important, where we really want to have kind of a barrier of encapsulation between these two parties. I may be providing you with information, and it may be that we really don't want you to know when you're done. It turns out this arrangement can't support that. Because I'll pass you this object, and then basically I'll watch my quota waiting for you to release it. And when my quota goes up, I know you're done. And that's information flow. Now, that's also true if the arrangement is that you're going to destroy the object. Right? I can observe that the object has been destroyed because my quota goes up. There are ways to make the quota information a little fuzzy. All those ways have other consequences in the system architecture that we might view as undesirable.
Oh.
Okay. But the reference count thing is especially bad because not only is there information disclosure, but there's resource held hostage. And the principle I want to propose here is basically, if I'm paying, I should get to destroy. And it may be that if I destroy it, I break something that you rely on. And if that's not okay, we need to re-engineer the contract. And there are going to be cases where it's not okay, and the solution is fix the contract. Maybe the solution is have somebody else pay. And there's a corollary to this, or there's a related property, second principle. No free rides. Hitchhikers are, you know, a bad thing in computational systems. If I can allocate a resource that I don't have to pay for, what we've done is we've architected in support for denial of resource, because resource isn't, the last time I looked, I didn't have an infinite disk drive, right? I didn't have an infinite memory. If I can allocate these resources, sooner or later I'm going to run out. Long before I run out, I'm going to put performance pressure on the system. That performance pressure is quite devastating. So if you have a situation where a resource is really getting bound to somebody, is getting allocated to somebody, somewhere it's got to be accounted for. There are some exceptions to this thing. You could take the view that a line in a cache is a resource and we ought to account for it. And actually, strictly speaking, if we're going to get obsessively concerned about detection of latency, that's actually correct. But if we can be a little fuzzy about latency, which is the case in normal systems, then no, a cache line is not a resource in the sense that I mean. And the reason it's not a resource is the system is always in a position without violating any contracts and without, for the most part, without you noticing, it's always in a position to evict your content from the cache and to pull it back in on demand. So this is a transient allocation. It's not a permanent allocation. Okay. And there are lots of reasons to do caching, and if we're going to go for aggressively high assurance, lots of hazards with doing caching, having to do with observation of timing, primarily. But, so the principle is, heap allocates pays. Okay, and the other one is, he who pays destroys. I can allocate, I can give you the right to destroy. I can allocate, I can be a damn fool, and I can give up the right to destroy. These are decisions that I can make. But the base condition has to be if I allocate it, I can destroy. Okay. And of course, it follows that if I'm paying, I can destroy. So I want to propose that we should look for a memory design in which these properties are not violated. Anybody think these properties in abstract are a bad idea? Maybe we'll run into a corner case where they might be very, very hard to achieve, but in abstract, they don't seem like unreasonable goals. Okay. Now, another property that we kind of like to get, and I've been dancing around it, okay, and I've said it's desirable, but let me put it up again. Is we'd like a certain uniformity of access control. The fewer mechanisms we have that deal with access control, the happier we're going to be, for two reasons. I mean, less mechanism, assuming I can get the job done acceptably, is just intrinsically better. Okay. But also, the fewer mechanisms I have to make access control decisions, the fewer ways there are for them to conflict. If I can get it down to one, it's really hard for the mechanism to conflict with itself. It may be broken, but it won't be self-contradicting. We can work on the broken part. And we've been talking about capabilities, so let me sort of offer an observation that I also think I said a few weeks ago. That if you look at a page table entry, it consists of a page frame number and a permissions mask.
Well, and a valid bit, which is actually kind of a funny thing.
But the page frame number is a resource ID, right? Namely, it's the identity of a piece of representation state. And the permissions describes a set of legal or illegal, depending on your point of view, legal operations. And in other contexts, we would call that an interface. And if you've been asleep for the part of the semester, then of course, right, you won't see that this is exactly how we define capability. But this capability is a little awkward. It's awkward mostly because
It's very specialized. It's designed to name pages and page permissions, which is a fine thing to do, but that 32-bit data structure on a 32-bit machine just doesn't have enough spare bits to describe the other capabilities that we'd like to have in the system. So the proposal is, one proposal is, let's reuse the idea, but we'll do it with a different data structure. Okay? So we'll introduce a data structure which says, this capability is a capability naming a page. It has in it an OID, an object ID, which tells us which page, right, and a set of permissions. Okay, just like before, that endpoint capability carried an OID and a protected payload. In fact, by the way, the endpoint capability is the only capability that actually needs to carry a protected payload. And it carries that in place of permissions, although it also actually carries probably two permission bits. And essentially, we're going to make a software capability structure that's a discriminated union, and this tag is going to tell us which kind it is. Okay, and as needed, we'll produce a page table entry. Now, one design you could do here, it's not the only feasible design, is you could say, well, if there was a parallel between page table entries and page capabilities, it might turn out that there was something that had a similar kind of a parallel with a page table. So, right, here's my page table with a page table entry. And what I might do is define a similar kind of a structure a software-defined structure that's going to contain page capabilities. Okay. And here's the page. And at least logically, the page table entry and the software capability might name the same page. One, the hardware version might be how we're going to represent for the convenience of the hardware what we said in the software version. Well, in fact, oops, I have a scaling problem with this diagram. This is exactly what the Eros system does. So in Eros, this data structure on the left is called a node. And it's like the page table has entries from 0 to 1024-1. Right? So it's 2 to the 10 bits wide. A node has 32 slots, 5 bits wide. And what we do is we build a two-level hierarchy of nodes, and this two-level hierarchy corresponds precisely to a page table. So the idea is we're going to have a process. That process is going to have a capability to a node that is the top of its address space, just like a page directory is the top of the hardware address space. That node is going to point to a node. These two things together are going to correspond to the page directory. Right? And there's going to be a pointer here that corresponds to the pointer to the page table. So really all we have here is two mapping structures, both represented in this case as trees. And as page faults occur, what we're going to do is basically walk this tree to figure out what the mapping is, compute what the mapping needs to be, and insert it in the hardware tree. And that's how we're going to resolve page faults. So I'm seeing some confused looks, and I've done this quickly, so let me stop and take questions on this.
Yes, sir.
There's about a billion optimizations on this that are necessary to make this work well, but I want to get the simple version out first. For small values of billion.
Why do you need the double, two layers of rows twice?
It's a pragmatics issue. You could just use, you know, a fatter tree, okay? The issue is, if you think about what goes on in a page table, the vast majority of the entries are unused. Okay? Only a few are going to be valid. And that would be true in the soft structure as well. The difference is the soft structure is four times bigger, so the cost of that underutilization is more expensive. And by bringing it up this way, we can get better utilization. It turns out that we don't get good enough utilization, and there's a refinement to the structure that I'm going to talk about probably tomorrow that the lab group has come up with that we're using in the next generation. But that's the quick answer. And some of the optimizations that we'll do will allow us under certain conditions to elide levels of the software tree because we know what they have to contain. So we're going to get back some storage by doing this. But in principle, we could do that. And the width of 32 is not magic. If we were to do this on a system which had a different page table size, then things wouldn't align so nicely, and the architecture has to be prepared to deal with that. In fact, earlier versions of this architecture, the width was 16. There's nothing magic about this particular width. Other questions? Yeah?
Can you start from the process again and just trace how you got through to the...
Okay. So here's what happens. The process issues an address. That's a loaded structure. Okay. The hardware watched the hardware page table and discovered there's no definition for that address. Okay. So what we do is we take the address and we treat it as describing a path through the software tree. We walk that path to figure out what the mapping needed to be. And we simply install the appropriate mapping in the hardware tables and restart the process. Now, in fact, better than that, we're going to walk that path in 2+ steps. Okay, here are the two obvious ones. First, we're going to walk the upper half to get this page directory entry. And then separately, we're going to walk the lower half to get the page table entry. Page table entry. And the reason why you want to do them separately is this allows us to share page tables. And the plus in the 2+ is actually this tree might be higher and we'll have to walk our way down to this level. And that's one of the various complications in the design, which for today we should probably ignore. So this is, you can think of this as a tree-to-tree projection that we're doing on demand. Now these nodes, where do they come from? Well, some application buys them. It goes to a storage allocator and it says, I need to buy a node. And that node comes out of its quota. This is not a kernel, well, okay, I'll finish the sentence and let me qualify it. This is not a kernel data structure. Now, what I mean by that, it is and it is not. It is a kernel data structure in the sense that we have to protect capabilities, so only the kernel is going to be allowed to look at the representation of a node. It's not going to be mapped into an application space. But it's not a kernel data structure in the sense that this data structure is not allocated by the kernel. It's allocated by the user, and its state is cached by the kernel on behalf of the application. But if you were to ask who owns this data structure, conceptually it's not owned by the kernel.
So when needed, according to the rules above, who destroys it?
Whoever holds the node capability.
So could the kernel can't do that?
No, in fact, in the Eros at least, the kernel can't destroy anything. So let me give you an example. The case, for pages, you can sort of see where would the kernel would destroy it, where would it go, right? I mean, you don't know what space bank it came from. But for processes, it's a little trickier, right? The process commits a fault, does some bad thing,
Obviously, you can't keep executing it, and we're all accustomed to Unix resolution being you kill the process. Okay, but where's the process going to go? It's come out of resource that's been allocated by somebody, and that somebody isn't listening to take it back. So the resolution in Eros is that that process, you mark it with a fault. It ceases to execute instructions. It's no longer a candidate for scheduling until the fault is cleared. And that's it. You don't do anything else with it. It is not the kernel's problem to clean up your storage messes for you. It's yours. And there's a hazard with putting policy of that sort in the kernel. And I think I talked about it the year you took the OS course. But the problem is that sooner or later, somebody will find a really good reason for an exception. An exceptional case.
Right.
And then the story will be, well, the kernel kills the process except on Sunday.
Right.
And on Sunday, it slaps the process around and tells it to behave more nicely next time and does some obscure thing to get things back on track. And then 5 years later, somebody will say, well, you know, but Tuesday's a little different.
Okay.
And pretty soon what you have is signal. When the Unix signals design was started, all signals were fatal.
Right.
And slowly, somebody said, oh, but signals is a good way to tell the application that it has made a memory mistake. And somebody else said, oh, but it might want to recover from that. And then, oh, well, you know, now we have an IPC mechanism. We might want to send user-defined signals from one process to another, thus SIGUSER. What about watchdog timers? Yeah, we could use signals for those. All these things are not fatal, unless, of course, the process has said they should be fatal, except on Thursdays when you need two kings and a jack. Okay, I will find the videotape, and I will bring that episode to class, and we'll just watch it instead of a lecture. It's great. It's a great lecture. It's a great episode. So, you know, better just not to start, right? So the deal, at least in the Eros kernel, is if a process takes a fault and we are able to identify a fault handler, we send a message to the fault handler. If there's no fault handler, the process stops executing instructions, and that's the end. We have set a fault code. If a fault handler should magically appear later, we will attempt to deliver a message. Also possible in Eros, but not on Kyoto, that a process might be malformed. It might be missing some parts. We won't try to execute those either. It may be so malformed that we can't figure out where the fault handler is. And under this policy I've just described, that's okay. It just doesn't make any progress. That's all right. On the other hand, it's a set of corner cases that are ugly, and that's why we're removing that, Kyoto's. Okay, so the structure here is one where, at least conceptually, you can see there's a translation from the left side to the right side. The devil is in the details, as Eric can tell you ad nauseum if you'll buy him beer or his beverage of choice. And there's a lot of details. But you can sort of, at a high level, see how you get from the left side to the right side, because trees are trees, and the fact that the tree width is changing isn't hugely exciting. Lots of detail in the implementation. Now, another possibility is you could say, well, I'm not going to try to start from this hardware intuition.
Right.
I personally like the hardware intuition mainly because, I mean, for two reasons. One is it satisfies this accountability property, and the other is that it puts a minimal barrier between me and what the hardware can actually express. Right? The hardware can express sharing. I'd like a mapping mechanism that does not preclude that. There are certain pieces of what the hardware can do that we have to strip out for reasons of security and protection. Aside from those, we'd like to fully expose the power of the hardware. And this mechanism mostly does that. But the other way you could go, well, there are a bunch. The classic one is to say, I have an address space. Inside that address space, I have something called a mapping. A mapping is essentially a window onto some kind of an object, like a file. And objects come from the file system or possibly the swap area. That would be mock or Unix. this hurts, don't do this. If I'm really, really good, I can get like 6 or 7 layers between me and the disk of different layers of translation to implement this design. You can do what the L4 guys do, and the L4 approach is kind of interesting. L4 says, look, the unit of mapping, we're going to take the view in L4 that an address space is basically it's a mapping in the mathematical sense. And the operation we're going to introduce is the ability to send, that is, the effect of the send is we're going to end up with a shared mapping. To the K pages, provided that they are naturally aligned. So if I'm sending 4 pages, it has to be 4 pages starting at some multiple of 4 pages. If it's 8 pages, it's got to be 8 pages starting at some multiple of 8 pages. So what they end up with in their structure is kind of a binary subdivision thing, right? They end up with a binary tree, lots of which is empty. And when they want to send a mapping, what happens is that inside the kernel, they execute a split in their software mapping structure so that now they have a data structure that represents this 2 to the k page point in the mapping, which is a well-defined point in the binary tree, and that's why it had to be naturally aligned. Okay. And now what they do is they copy that, that's called a mapping database node in their lingo. They create a new mapping database node in the receiver, and they hook it into the receiver's address space. Okay. This operation is called map. Okay. And essentially, you build a relationship between the sender's database node and the receiver's database node. Now, the reason this relationship exists is because they have the dual operation called unmap, where the party who has previously done a map can recursively revoke all mappings that have been constructed. Does this design satisfy the explicit allocation test? Okay. Eric points out that over here I did not explain who pays for the kernel page tables. Remember I said caches don't count? So Eris treats kernel page tables as a cache, because the official state is always here, and the kernel page table can always be rebuilt. In principle, that would be feasible in either of these systems. The current L4 implementation does not actually do it that way. There's some information that you would need to rebuild mapping tables that you could record in the database notes. They currently only record that information in mapping tables, but that's an artifact of the implementation. It's not an attribute of the architecture. Does this satisfy our allocation requirement?
Do the lower level things, I mean, so you have, you know, your top level thing that maps to the address space, and you can hand some of it to something else. Mm-hmm. The lower level thing, does the lower level thing pay for that mapping? Who's paying for the mapping?
You tell me. Who should pay?
Well, from one point of view, the guy at the top should pay for all the mappings, but that doesn't really make very much.
Why is that? You should not pay for what I use. Sure.
Yeah, there's...
I mean, wouldn't your outcome be exactly the free ride we're trying to avoid, right?
Right. It's a question of if the top guy is allowed to unmap everything, if the ones underneath are the ones who are paying for things and allocating, you know, so-called allocating them, the fact that the guy at the top then go down and destroy all of them, it makes it very, it seems like it would make it difficult.
I've asked you a slippery question. Okay. The answer is yes, this satisfies the requirements. And no, it does not satisfy the intent of the requirements. Satisfies the requirements in the following sense. First, the mappings are explicit. You know that if you do a map operation, you're going to allocate exactly one database type. Not true in the current implementation, but true in principle. Second, you know that if you're the party who allocated the node, the database node, you're in a position to revoke it. So far, so good. The place where it fails is you don't pay for allocating the database node. This turns out to be a definitive data structure that the kernel cannot revoke that you are not paying for in its kernel state in this design. And there are hypothetical designs, none yet implemented, and they appear possibly overcomplicated, in which the kernel, in order to allocate this database node that in effect you requested, would go to a heap that holds storage that you have previously provided. And then the billing would be right, but right now the billing is not right. And that heap turns out to be fraught with challenge. And they're finding that design, they're testing that design, and it's very, very difficult. They may yet find a way to reconcile. But there's another problem. So Zen.
Yeah.
You see that there's a trap in here.
Yeah.
And it's maybe resolvable and they're working on it, but it's not yet clear what the outcome is. But there's actually a bigger trap here. The bigger trap is, turns out that the L4 group wants to use question is, what's the mechanism by which capabilities are transferred? And in the traditional capability system, the answer is, I copy a capability to you, maybe I copy you a reduced capability, but if I copy to you a capability that I hold, your copy is co-equal to my copy, right? It's just like if I copy the value 5 to you, your value 5 is independent from my value 5. Right? So capability copy has value semantics in traditional capability systems. Because they had this map operation ready to hand, and because in some sense, having decided to use it to move page table entries, at least logically, they were, in effect, already using it for capability transfer. The L4 folks have decided that their implementation of capability transfer should be map. So rather than try to get into picking on L4, which I'm going to do, but I want to do it in somewhat neutral terms, so the question is, which one should be the primitive operation? Copy or revocable copy? You have to have both. You clearly want to have both because there are times when you need to send me a capability that you can revoke. And in the L4 mechanism, that's very natural because it comes intrinsic in the map operation. In the Eros design, I actually have to put a wrapper around the capability so that I can later destroy the wrapper. Both systems can accomplish the function. Either system can emulate the function of the other in this regard. So a revocable copy is one where I ship it to you and later I can cancel it. And a copy is one where I ship you the capability, I can't undo your capability unless the object itself supports a method for self-destruct. In which case, all capabilities are going to go, but it's not because I sent it to you, it's because the object's gone. So what I'd like you to think about for tomorrow, I'm going to pick this up tomorrow, which one of these is the right operation to have as primitive? And let me say, in a kernel, implementing revocable copy is tricky because in order to support later revoke, I'm going to have to build something conceptually similar to the database node because I'm going to have to record who got it. So my question for you, though, is think about the kind of system you might want to build on top of this and ask yourself which of these operations is likely to be more frequent and why. Let's talk about that tomorrow. Meantime, any other questions? I will get a schedule out for the midterm here. Okay.